Matter of State v. James Hemenway. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Mr. Court. Mr. Bertuccio from the law firm Russo, Mola, Hartman, and Lento. I'm the appellant. I'm being assisted by W.S. Hartman and Jessica Wilson, who are on the briefs.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Ronald Chen, of the Constitutional Rights Clinic, representing the Superior ICC of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Prosecutor David Ben listed appearing on behalf of the city.
Deputy Attorney General Frank Morosky appearing on behalf of the Attorney General. That's going to be
close. Welcome, counsel. Mr. Bertuccio, please go ahead.
Thank you.
First, if I may I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Not sure whether it's going to be necessary, but just in case.
We'll have you back, hopefully, for a little less. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Today, this court gets to address an issue squarely before it now that was raised but not decided in a dissenting opinion in State versus Harris. In preparing for this argument, even though we did hundreds of hours of research and briefs and everything, my argument's fairly simple and straightforward. The United States Constitution, and for that matter the Constitution of New Jersey, does not allow for a warrant to issue except upon probable cause, not reasonable cause, which other cases have equated to reasonable suspicion, and it must also state with particularity the items sought to be seized and with particularity where they are, in addition to which there's a requirement of a factual basis upon which to determine the probable cause and the particularity, and there has to be some temporal proximity to what is being alleged to be seized in relation to the events leading to it. In this case, which even though it's a domestic violence situation in its primacy, is essentially a criminal case because every domestic violence case needs a predicate offense, which is always a criminal offense. And so my simple argument to this court is that the standard under which this application should have been reviewed was probable cause. And looking at the transcript that's in the record from June 28, 2012 from Union County, critically at pages 4 and 5, the essence of this entire application is the following colloquy beginning at line 19. The court, okay, I'm going to, do you have an awareness that he has any weapons? Answer, yes. What kind of weapons do you claim he has? Handguns, knives is the answer. Question, a handgun? Then the answer is knives, blades. Nothing about a handgun. Question, handguns? Answer, switchblades. Question, knives? Answer, switchblades. And then where does he have these weapons? In special compartments in his car. That's it. Absolutely nothing in there about the residents in Middlesex County. Importantly to this case factually, the alleged victim was not in a cohabitation with my client. They were not living in Middlesex County together. She was living in Elizabeth. The events that she alleged happened in Elizabeth. The other transcript that I believe is critical is what eventually happens on July 11, 2012, when the final restraining order trial or hearing occurs, where the judge in that case finds not only is there not a relationship protected under the domestic violence law, because they weren't in a dating relationship, they were in a business relationship, but also they did not prove that the allegations of the predicate act had it actually occurred. And in fact, when they executed this warrant, which they executed twice, once on June 30th and again on July 2nd, they found no weapons. They seized no weapons. What happened instead is when they got to the apartment and my client met them outside, there was an exchange. My client said, you can just serve me with this here. I'm on the phone with my lawyer. Just give me the paperwork. I'll come down to the police department. That led to an arrest, which I maintain was an illegal arrest, but that's an issue for an aside here. And then as they entered the lower part of the apartment building and smelled marijuana, the source of which they could not pinpoint, but saw air fresheners leading up the stairs, this ceased to be a domestic violence-related search at all and became a search for drugs. And that search was illegal. And everything that happened from the point that they crossed the precipice of that apartment building until they finished searching my client's cars 3 days later, which the trial court judge found in the motion to suppress was allowed 3 days later under the domestic violence search warrant, notwithstanding that the criminal search warrant they got, that judge found to be lacking in probable cause. All of that should be suppressed. That's the essence of my argument. And that's my opening statement. So,
Counselor, can I start with, did I understand to say that prosecutions of the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act are criminal?
The predicate offenses.
However, we'll agree that they're civil cases.
Domestic violence is a civil case,
okay.
But the predicate offenses are all criminal offenses. And in fact, allegations were to be believed, he could have been charged with aggravated assault, possession of a weapon for unlawful
purpose. That's not brought in a domestic violence act. That would be for the prosecutor to make a decision out on a totally different proceeding.
That's true,
but
it emanates.
Domestic violence is only about protecting the individual alleged to have been threatened with violence.
But all of that would emanate from what originally is a domestic violence situation. So because of that, I respectfully submit that the Fourth Amendment requirement of probable cause must occur in these circumstances.
All right, so it's question number two. You indicated that I understand the argument about the guns, supposed to be switchblades, whatever it was, and I understand the argument. But you said that they did not live together. The Prevention of Domestic Violence Act doesn't require the complainant to live together. It can be separate homes. Because the main purpose is to protect the victim of alleged domestic violence.
I agree with your statement, but I made that statement because it goes to the lack of cause, probable cause here. If this were a situation where they lived together, you might have more of a factual basis from which to conclude
that there's probable cause. Okay.
She's never been in this apartment.
All right, but you don't need to be to file a protective violence.
You don't need to get a restraining order.
Right.
But I respectfully submit that there's got to be some sort of basis of knowledge upon which a court can rely to say in a residence in a different county that you've never been in has weapons in it.
Do you agree we should not be looking at the hearing at the final restraining order? We should be looking at the hearing on June 28th?
Yes. I only point out the final restraining order hearing because some of the findings by Judge Kirsch go back to some of the defects of findings that occurred.
Yeah, but you can't collaterally attack the information that was provided on June 28th, 2012, based upon information learned at the final restraining order. Even if it's inconsistent, the judge who had to decide whether or not to issue the warrant is relegated to the information before him.
I agree with that, Justice Alvin. I only pointed out because things that came up in the hearing, and I'm not asking you to apply that backward in time, show some of the defects and some of the questions that should have been asked when the initial restraining order was being sought. And that's my point, such as, are you in fact in a relationship covered by the Domestic Violence Act? How do you know where these weapons are?
Isn't that one of the predicate findings before you're going to a judge presiding over a domestic violence case must determine that it falls within the PDVA, and one of the criteria is that there be a dating or some other familiar relationship. You can't get a restraining order against your co-employee because he's threatening you.
I agree.
Wasn't that part of the findings that the judge made?
Yes, because he does ask if she was in a dating relationship. She says yes. I agree. But as you get into this deep, you find out that, in fact, she wasn't. But I don't want to get too distracted with that, so maybe...
Your point is the search.
My point's the search.
And your argument is you need probable cause in order to enter and conduct the search.
Right, which is woefully lacking in the June 28th, 2012 transcript, and that's the essence of my argument, Chief Justice.
Questions?
Why don't you walk us through the statute and tell us what what parts of the statute you think should fall under your analysis? Because I take it you're troubled by the good cause shown standard and the reasonable cause,
which has been defined by the case law as the equivalent of reasonable suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
So under the three prongs...
of J.
Yes. The first prong requires a probable cause determination, and I think that was articulated in an earlier case from this court.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe Your Honor was the author of that case.
I think
case.
It was.
And DeSpoto, I believe. But the other two prongs, especially the one about search warrants, only requires reasonable cause. If this were a reasonable suspicion investigation of a home, that alone would not gain entry to the home by the police.
Mm-hmm.
And it should not be the reason to gain entry to this home here either, especially considering that we did not have an agent circumstance. This was not a domestic violence situation that was happening violently at the moment the police arrive, or the people live in the same home together and they're going to be separated. It wasn't that type of situation.
If it was, would it be your position that they could enter based on reasonable cause but could not use anything that was found for criminal purposes?
No. My position is you can't enter the home unless in probable cause, either having a warrant or having an exigent circumstance.
Okay.
If you were just to take this case and set aside the DV Act and say that this is essentially an allegation of an assault and the police are responding in response to that, what can they lawfully do at a residence where it's not occurring at a different time after it's occurred?
Suppose they were living together in the
home. Or they got to have an exigent circumstance.
But suppose they were living together in the home. The female in this relationship makes the allegation of the threat of violence or the occasion of violence, and the order is issued, and there's a search, or the police go to the home where the two are.
My position is the same.
Okay.
It's the same.
How can we set aside the originated in Prevention of Domestic Violence Act? How can we set aside that act in order to enact what you seek when the very statute says reasonable cause?
Well, except reasonable cause, Your Honor, is not defined in the statute. It's defined in case law. And certainly this court can determine constitutionally that's a synonym for probable.
You're asking us to replace reasonable cause with probable cause. Since the Senate has written many statutes regarding probable cause, can we assume that they know there's a difference and that's why they wrote reasonable cause and that's what they intended?
Well, if that's what they intended, then they did it unconstitutionally.
Your position is the legislature has to conform its statutes to the Constitution.
Exactly.
And if it doesn't do so, we are required either to strike down the statute or to conform the statute to the Constitution.
Yes, and I would suggest the prudent, perhaps more conservative course would be to simply conform that section of the statute to the Constitution.
So Steve versus Johnson, which is, I guess, the governing law, had three standards. And the dissent in Harris suggested that the appropriate standard would be probable cause that it was an act of domestic violence, probable cause to believe that a search for and seizure of weapons is necessary to protect the life, health, or well-being of the victim, and probable cause to believe the weapons are located at a particular location.
That is the simple statement that solves the problem that's before this court today.
Talk about the third prong of that probable cause that the weapons are located at a particular location. The legislature clearly wanted to protect women and other potential men who may be subject to domestic violence and provide special protections for that group of people. If someone has, for example, if someone in her own home has been subjected to domestic violence and there is a weapon that she's aware of because the perpetrator has brought the weapon with him or her, when you impose an obligation to a probable cause with respect to the location of that weapon, why isn't that contrary to what the legislature wants to do here? And that is to provide very quick and effective protection so that people are not hurt or killed.
I have two answers to that question. First, if this were a situation where they were cohabitating, there would be a much more substantial basis in the transcript of June 28, 2012 as to the present location of that weapon. And the victim also has property and proprietary interests in that residence.
Sure, that's an easy one. That's an easy one. I'm talking about a situation where, you know, domestic violence does not necessarily happen to people who are living together.
You're right.
The domestic violence might have happened at her home, assuming a dating relationship or other protective relationship exists.
Justice Patterson, I respectfully submit that the Domestic Violence Act cannot supersede the Constitution.
Understand.
And essentially say that if I allege that somebody in a relationship with me threatened the use of a weapon on me, that person is now subjected to a search of every car they own and every house they own.
Sir, respectfully, that's not my question.
Okay.
I was focusing on the third prong of the Harris formulation of probable cause, and it requires some specificity with respect to the location of weapons.
I agree with that.
And so you're saying that should be the case.
Yes.
As if it were any other situation.
Any other search warrant.
Any other search warrant. So even so that person, there's no warrant can be issued if the person says, if the alleged victim says, he came over here, he's told me he was going to kill me, he had a gun, I don't know where it is. No warrant.
No warrant. Because it's no different than a criminal case. If a member of this panel were sitting at the trial court level, and I'm a prosecutor or I'm an investigator, and I come in and that's the allegations, and I go to Your Honor and say, Judge Patterson, I want you to sign a warrant for his house, you're going to say, well, how do we know there's anything in the house?
Well, I think that may, well, look, even under a typical criminal case, a person is threatened with a handgun. Let's take that. It doesn't have to be a domestic violence case. That alone might be sufficient to secure a warrant to search the person's house for a gun. Once, if you determine where the person lives, and there is clear evidence that the person was in possession of a gun. No? You don't think so?
I'd need to know more specifics.
That's getting close to it, because if you can't find the defendant, and you're looking for him, and you're looking for the gun.
I don't know that warrant would be issued. I think you'd need more to connect the house to the weapon.
Well, you've got to have. So the person who happens to have been attacked or threatened in a home where she knows where the gun is, where it happens to be kept, the warrant is issued in that case. But in a case where the person doesn't have that access to that knowledge, sorry, no warrant.
Well, it depends. No, just more information needs to be developed.
Well, this case comes. I'm not saying meets it, but comes close to it. To the probable cause. The victim goes before judge, sentence, says, he threatened to kill me. She also says, at least at one point, that he has handguns and switchblades in the vehicles and in the apartment. There isn't a search. Assuming there's a basis of knowledge, and she said, and I saw the handgun, and I saw the switchblades in his apartment. Under those circumstances, would you say it meets all three prongs?
If you had those facts, yes.
Yes, and that's not much. The problem with the present transcript is there wasn't a very detailed colloquy, and part of the reason, and this is not to cast any blame on the trial judge, is that the standards haven't really been clear.
Exactly. And so what's missing here, if you apply the probable cause standard, is number one, there's no discussion of any knowledge by this alleged victim that any of these so-called weapons are in the
residence.
Had the
judge taken 30 seconds more or even a minute more, he could have said, how do you know they're in the apartment? Because I've been there, and where in the apartment have you seen them?
Didn't ask that.
And you can see under those circumstances, with just a little additional questioning, you could have probable cause on all three prongs.
I agree with you, Justice Alvin, but to get back to your question, Justice Patterson, that hypothetical gives us a connection back to the house. Hey, I've been in the house. I know he's got weapons in the house.
I just wanna,
then
I
your, have no argument.
And your position is the person who's attacked or threatened in her home and just doesn't know the layout of the person's house, has never been there, is it in a relationship as stated in the statute, is there's no warrant. because of that fact.
Still gets
under
the full panoply of protections.
Under the standard you want us to apply.
Yes, and still gets the full panoply of protections.
Assume a murder case. I mean, because that is an aggravated assault case. Assume a charge of murder where there's a handgun was used and where the defendant's residence is known. Are you suggesting under those circumstances a judge would be loath to issue a search warrant for the gun in the person's home?
There has to be, my answer to the question is yes without more, because there has to be not only probable cause, but you have to state with particularity where you expect the weapon to be and where you're going to search for it. And that's what's lacking here. This case on its facts, I would say, Justice Alden, is the perfect case to change the law to probable cause, because obviously you hit the nail on the head that the judge didn't feel he had to go any farther because he thought the standard was lower. But adopting the probable cause standard of this set of facts, the simple solution for this case is that the warrant's illegal and everything that flowed therefrom has to be suppressed as the fruits of the poisonous tree. Chief Justice, I interrupted you.
That's all right. Would you like to address the special needs exception?
I really wanted my partner to do that, but I'll do it. When I look at the special needs exceptions, I want to say first, looking at the law throughout the nation, virtually all of the statutes require either probable cause for the search warrant or first a voluntary surrender to the person and then a different but more searching inquiry than the reasonable cause standard in New Jersey. The special needs cases that I've seen, all of which I think are distinguishable from this case, where special needs have been upheld, involve administrative searches or searches by people that are not in law enforcement, whether it be school officials in a school dealing with a reasonable cause search of a pocketbook like TLO or routine searches of lockers, or they're people that are routinely urine testing athletes in schools to see if there's any performance-enhancing drugs, or for that matter, recreational drugs that could put them or others in the sport in danger, or situations where a health officer wants to go in because perhaps there's a property that's not been cleared to be a private residence, but somebody's living there. Things of that nature. And I think the case that's cited in the dissent, and Harris talks about Camara, the Camara case, which I think is a good explication of the difference between special needs in those cases and this situation here, which even though I agree the Domestic Violence Act is not criminal in nature, it's got aspects of criminality and the evidence that's generated from it can lead to criminal charges. And that's why I don't think the special needs exception would apply here. And it should be a simple calculus of probable cause, with the benefit to the state that if they meet that standard and there are evidence of criminality found, such as in this case, independent of weapons, then that person is subject to prosecution, provided that the warrant is good, which it is not here.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Not at this time. I thank you for your time.
Dean Chen.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Radner, and may it please the court. If I can begin with a prefatory remark, an acknowledgement. This is actually one of the more difficult cases that I think the ACLU and myself in particular have presented to this court. We completely realize, acknowledge, and appreciate the strong interest in preventing domestic violence, and we would not want to do anything unnecessarily to prevent that act, and therefore it is with some mixed feelings and I will say a huge amount of consultation up to the legal director, national legal director of the ACLU, on what our position should be on this, and certainly not without any eagerness that we eventually came to the conclusion that we did, that as written 2C 2528J cannot be held against Fourth Amendment standards, and as we outline in our brief, we hope to suggest ways in which as much of the statute as can be reasonably be preserved, can be preserved. I realize it is not the role of amicus to revisit the waterfront, so I just wanted to stress three particular points, and then as time and the court's patience permits, I'll explain them and answer any other questions the court may have. The three points I wanted to make in particular are, one, that a search warrant is an inquiry into whether there is evidence of a crime. It is not an inquiry into whether there is cause, whether probable, reasonable, or otherwise, that the subject has committed a crime, which would be the standard for an arrest warrant. And it is certainly not an inquiry into whether the subject might commit a crime in the future. And that that threshold requirement drives much of ACLU's position. The second point we wanted to make is that the searches permitted under this statute, we believe, cannot fairly be characterized as performed for reasons unrelated to law enforcement, that the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act is inextricably intertwined in law enforcement and must be treated as such. And the third point we wanted to make is actually stresses a lot that not the constitutional, but the statutory requirement, which is backed up, buttressed by the constitutional requirement, that the judge must state with specificity the reasons for and scope of any search authorized, which the legislature, as well as the Constitution, have found necessary to insert. So on the first point, the most obvious, it might seem the most obvious facial reason to object constitutionally to the statute is that it literally lowers the standard from probable cause to reasonable cause in textual contradiction to the constitutional standard. But actually, we think that the more difficult constitutional issue might be raised by the fact that the statute does not ask the judge to inquire into whether there is cause of whatever level. Does not ask the judge to determine whether there is cause to find that evidence of a crime will be found, but instead inquires into whether a firearm or other weapon will be found, possession of which might be completely, perfectly legal. And if that aspect of the statute is upheld, our fear is that it really doesn't matter whether it's reasonable cause, probable cause, clear and convincing evidence. It opens up the statute to be almost a wild card that will allow search of all parts of a home, searching for items that in and of themselves are not evidence of a crime. Hopefully being presumptuous, I could say I have probable cause to believe now that everyone in this courtroom has a weapon in their home, in their kitchen drawer, in their toolbox, in their garden shed. And so unless there is some way to cabin that part of the statute, we believe that runs afoul of constitutional norms. At this point, I'd like to address an argument, actually, that the Attorney General made in its amicus brief. The Attorney General argued that this search was based on probable cause. I think it was on page 14 of its amicus brief, because a predicate to issuing a search warrant under the statute is that there is probable cause to believe that the subject committed an act of domestic violence. And without getting into whether that is actually what the statute requires or not under the DeSpoto case, I'll take that as a given now. With all great due respect to the Attorney General, I think that conflates or confuses the standard for probable cause to issue an arrest warrant with probable cause to issue a search warrant. This court addressed this topic to a great extent in State versus Chapiro, with Justice Lovecchio. We'll probably remember the case in which it noted that there's fundamentally arrest warrants and search warrants protect different interests. The factual predicate for a showing of probable cause to arrest may not be necessarily the same as required for probable cause to search. And finally, the court noted probable cause to arrest and probable cause to search involve distinct and not necessarily identical inquiries, a finding of probable cause as to one does not mean that probable cause as to the other must follow, nor does the lack of one compel a finding that there is a lack of support for the other. So because this was a search warrant, we respectfully suggest that whether there was probable cause or not to believe that the subject committed the act of domestic violence does not answer the question, which would be sufficient to issue an arrest warrant. That does not answer the question of whether there was probable cause for a search warrant, because there you're searching for evidence of a crime in the place to be searched, and the two are not coterminous. Unless we believe that the court limits the search warrant to those instances in which there is probable cause to believe there's evidence of a crime, then, as I said, it runs, but instead inquires into whether a weapon, as very broadly defined, can be found. That's when it could degenerate into suspicionless searches of homes without any effective limitation. The second point that
Dean Chen, if yes. I may, if a victim reports and the court is satisfied that there has been a threat with a gun. Let's leave aside the kitchen knives and all the rest, but there's been a threat with a gun, not necessarily the gun present on the scene, but a threat to kill the person. And the court is satisfied that there is probable cause to conclude that the perpetrator has threatened that individual with a gun. And that gun is legally owned. Mm-hmm. Is that gun subject to confiscation?
I believe it is under the Act, and I think it also, therefore, would be that gun in itself, even if legally owned, would constitute evidence of a crime. If, in fact, it was used in a threat to someone,
yeah,
that
and
is a crime.
I maybe wasn't clear enough. It isn't on the scene. The person is not threatened with a gun, but the victim knows the individual has a gun, and the individual says, "I'm going to come back and I'm going to kill you and the kids, etc." This is hypothetical. This is
yes,
the case, okay?
I think,
so you know there's a gun.
Yeah.
You know it's legally owned. It can in accordance with the statutory authority, can the police constitutionally confiscate that gun?
Well, certainly under the Act, they're given that power.
Yes.
Whether a search without, in that case, I would have to say the gun itself is not evidence of a crime that has been committed, and therefore that the confiscation would be a prophylactic.
It's prophylactic, and that's what the statute apparently, you know, the statute seems to me, and you tell me you've studied it, it seems to me to be the legislature's attempt to respond to the fact that people are killed on very quickly in these situations. They may report a crime and be dead the next day, and the legislature is trying to save lives here. So it is prophylactic. I would agree with you. Okay. Is it constitutional?
I believe the act of confiscation, the ACLU would not contest the act of confiscation. What we suggested in our brief in that case, if there is not traditional probable cause to issue a warrant, a search warrant, that in that case, and if the purpose is prophylactic, then its purpose is prophylactic and not for prosecuting law enforcement, and that is when we suggest that what you are searching for non-law enforcement purposes could not be used in the subsequent crime.
So, but the hypothetical that Justice Patterson gave you was a potential violation of criminal law or a threat to commit a crime with a weapon. Probable cause could be found based on the facts in that situation as to a crime that is being planned, and that would justify the seizure under Chaparro as well.
I understood Justice Patterson's question to be that the gun was not actually used in the
gun
threat. I think it's easier if the gun were used in the threat.
Yeah.
No.
There is a crime. The
Someone
gun
says, I'm
going to
kill
crime.
You, and I've got a gun back at the apartment. Let's assume a judge reasonably infers probable cause from that. You could conduct a search under a warrant.
Probably one. I suppose what I can make the argument is if the person says, I've got a gun in the back of the apartment, and that amounts to reasonably construed as a threat to use the gun, then that threat constitutes the crime, and the gun is evidence of the crime.
All right, so the question then becomes the quantum of proof. Your argument is that it needs to be by a standard of probable cause.
Yes. for a search warrant to be issued in which the evidence then can be used in a law enforcement or criminal proceeding.
In the example given by Justice Patterson, given prong two of my suggestion, probable cause to believe a search for and seizure of a weapon is necessary to protect the life, health, or well-being of the victim in whose behalf the relief is sought. And the last part of that is just a quotation right out of the Domestic Violence Act. Would you say that meets constitutional standards?
For the confiscation and for use prophylactic?
Yes.
Yes.
How about?
I would still then say, though, that if it does not meet the test of a warrant being issued for probable cause of evidence of a crime, then it can't be used. Any ensuing discovery cannot be used in a criminal prosecution.
How about what usually a very common occurrence in domestic violence hearings? I've been sat in the family division for a little bit. I haven't heard those cases where the person comes in and says, I've received some threatening phone calls. I've been assaulted in the past. You know, I dismissed the restraining order. I fear for my life. No mention of weapons. Would it be appropriate as a prophylactic and in support of Prevention of Domestic Violence Act to search the home for those guns on that situation?
Again, without probable cause to believe that there's evidence of your crime for use in a criminal prosecution, I would have to answer no.
I can tell you, a lot of those cases, that's a situation, and many times guns are fine, sometimes they're not, but most people come in and say, I've been threatened, I'm afraid for my life, I'm afraid the person's going to kill me or injure me severely, and there's no mention of whether they have guns or not, and the purpose of the search is to make sure there are no weapons in the home.
I would respectfully suggest that the court should probably give instructions to the family part in this case to make further inquiry to see if there is reason to believe that there is a gun, as we suggest in our brief. Part of the problem with the statute is that it is a potentially such great breadth, any quote weapon, which we all have knives, kitchen knives. If it were limited to a search for firearms or other weapons of inherently lethal nature, as we just got in brief, and if then the family part judge were to inquire as to whether there is probable cause to believe that there was possession of such guns, then I think we're within constitutional norms.
Are you suggesting, it sounds like you're saying, I'm not sure, are you suggesting that the presence of the police officer in that residence to look for weapons is illegal, or that the search under the Fourth Amendment is legal and therefore whatever the weapons they discover cannot be used as evidence of a crime?
If, the various scenarios, obviously the simple one is that the police officer is there pursuant to a search warrant that meets probable cause and Fourth Amendment standards there. If the police officer is there pursuant to a warrant that does not meet Fourth Amendment standards, does not meet probable cause, or does not meet the particularity requirement, but which the legislature has deemed as necessary to meet an exigent circumstance in order to prevent safety, I would say that the police officer's presence there is permissible, but then I think we have to enforce the requirement which is embedded in the special needs exception that it is not the business of law enforcement.
I was leading to something.
Yeah, go ahead.
You're saying, I'm sorry, Justice Allen, let me just finish up the follow-up question. If their presence is permissible and they see in plain view other evidence of a crime, not related to guns, not related to domestic violence, what happens there?
I was anticipating that question.
I thought you might.
I would say in that case, if the police officer is validly there, but not pursuant to a valid probable cause warrant, then the police officer is validly there and the plain view doctrine would apply to other evidence, but not to the evidence that he was there to confiscate unless then, because that would then make, frankly, mincemeat of the...
I don't understand that. They can't use criminally the weapon that they were there to search for if probable cause is not present.
Yeah.
But they can use for criminal prosecution purposes, anything else that they see?
Well, then if the police officer is validly there, then I can't think of any reason why the plain view doctrine would normally apply. And if he happens to see other evidence of illegality,
is he validly there under Section J?
Well, that I think really comes back to, is Section J valid? Is he validly there under Section J as written?
Right.
Yes, because virtually any police presence, any search by a police officer can be validated under Section J.
But is that valid as you understand it? Is it satisfactory to rely on the reasonable cost standard?
No. Not for purposes of law enforcement. And
so then how does a confiscation take place? If you're saying, and I think what I'm hearing you say is that the legislature has indicated that there are situations in which it's important, exigency, whether it's exigency as a, you know, for Fourth Amendment purposes or not, there is a need to potentially confiscate a firearm. Let's use the easy question of a firearm. Okay. So can they go to, if they have something short of traditional probable cause, can they go search for and seize a firearm?
To confiscate.
Yes.
Consistent with the language, they have reasonable cause under the statute, but not probable cause under the Constitution. ACLU would not argue against the interest in having him to meet
just
that
to get
exigency,
the gun out of
to
the
get
home.
The gun out
of the home.
But
okay.
In order that
so,
that exception
just,
does
just
not
follow
become,
up if I may. So,
does
so,
not swallow the rule, which is what, that is why we suggest that.
Yeah. But you're saying that if he's prosecuted, he or she is prosecuted for possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose or unlawful possession of a weapon or whatever it may be, the evidence is suppressed.
Right. For that, and I want to stress, we hopefully are talking about a fairly narrow bandwidth of cases where the gap between reasonable cause and probable cause. In a lot of these cases, there will be probable cause to believe that there's evidence of a crime, as we discussed. And in that case, all we need to do is tell the family park judges, who are as authorized to issue a criminal search warrant as any other superior court judge, to just make the appropriate findings. And we think that would be the simplest way to make the statute effective without offending the
Constitution. What is your view of the, I'm sorry, Chief, if I may, just one more. What is your view of the formulation in Justice Albin's dissent in Harris, the three-part formulation of a probable cause standard for domestic violence?
Obviously, as
I mean,
said,
I'm speaking for the, I mean, you're speaking for the ACLU.
Yeah. We find, as we said in our brief, we've substantially agreed with all of Justice Albin's dissent. I don't say that.
With everything he's ever said.
Well, I wouldn't.
Careful.
I wouldn't go that far, but that's another case. I just want to understand the interpretation. Justice Albin's tests, as to the point that I'm addressing, does it require a probable cause of evidence of a crime?
Mm-hmm.
Not literally, but what I thought what Justice Albin was suggesting is this is what can make a search fit under the special needs exception, and with the proviso that I just provided, we're in agreement with that.
But, and then just one last follow-up, and I will stop. Sorry, Chief. I'm sorry you were trying to get a question out. The third prong, which I spoke to your colleague about, what happens when the victim comes in? It's a stalker. It's somebody that the victim has never been to the home, doesn't know, never seen the guns. He says he has a gun. He says he's going to use it. Or, you know, in a relationship, whatever it is, it fits within the relationship. Is probable cause met?
Well, if he says he has a gun and he's going to use it, that is a crime.
And I'm sorry, I probably wasn't clear enough, even if the victim is just not in a position to say his apartment, he keeps the guns in a, you know, gun safe, doesn't really have any knowledge of where the gun is.
I guess what I would do is step back first and say, if, of course, the statute provides for some first intermediate steps, which is order him to hand over any guns. I would probably, before we reach that more difficult question, Justice Patterson, I think there should at least be a finding by the judge why those lesser steps, ordering him to turn over the gun.
Agreed. Assuming that hasn't worked.
Is unnecessary or insufficient.
But look, if the person has a gun and it's lawfully owned, he has an obligation to store it safely. So the dots are going to connect to him likely, based on a reasonable probable cause basis, that it would be in the person's home. So if they can identify the person's home, why wouldn't that be sufficient?
Ironically, Justice Lovecki, because I did look into this, New Jersey's laws on how you store guns are much more lax than other states. But I would agree with this proposition.
In what way?
They don't apparently require, for instance, that you keep it in a gun safe.
You can have it loaded in your house. You can have a gun loaded in your house. You shouldn't have children around. That will create other problems.
There's no storage requirement.
But can't reasonable inferences be drawn for a probable cause finding that the person is going to have the gun in his place where he
certainly
resides?
In that case, if there's probable cause to believe that he has threatened use of a gun, and we know he has a gun, then I think that it's a very different situation, certainly from this current case. I would not argue strongly against the belief that probable cause, that there's probable cause to believe the gun is in his home. But that's, again, not to be repetitive. Here we're stressing guns.
Right.
If we expand that to knives, then the inquiry obviously becomes almost meaningless.
I want to go back to one of your earlier answers because I'm not sure I understood it, and then come back to the test. It sounded that you're saying you need probable cause or an exception to the warrant requirement, of course, in order to get entry and conduct a search. Were you suggesting some alternative category like exigency light? Because if you have exigency, you have a basis to enter and seize and use that weapon criminally.
I was probably being somewhat imprecise with the use of the word exigent. What I suppose I was referring to is actually Justice Albin's test for what might make the circumstances constitutionally fit within the special needs.
Understood. So looking at that test, is it always necessary that all three elements be proven? For example, if the weapon and the third element was evidence of a crime, was in and of itself an unlawful weapon, that would be satisfactory proof all by itself, no?
If there was a belief that someone unlawfully held a weapon, then I think that would probably satisfy the probable cause standards, and we would never problem.
And depending on the nature of the proofs for the second prong, if it established exigency, that alone would be sufficient without proof of one and three as well?
And not meaning to walk back my words, but exigency, obviously, we'd argue, has to be very strictly defined as obviously not more than mere inconvenience. It has to be true exigency.
You wouldn't need a warrant if you had exigent circumstances.
Now, in these cases where someone has gone to a family court judge, the argument that it's impractical to get a warrant is somewhat difficult to make.
And that would incorporate a temporal proximity into the analysis as well.
Yes.
Your alternate theory of like reasonable cause is certainly not reflected in the Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment doesn't even talk about crimes. It talks about unreasonable searches and seizures of homes, correct?
Yes.
I mean, even administrative warrants, Camara case, required probable cause because of the nature of the search and the sanctity of the home.
I certainly did not mean to be misunderstood as espousing a new theory of reasonable cause. Indeed, I'm advocating against adoption of that new standard because, as you're right, it is nowhere to be found except, of course,
in
the words of the statute. And I would have to agree, just focusing on something that Justice Fernandez-Vigna asked very early on. Normally, I would try my best to use constitutional avoidance to construe a statute, but in this case, I think it's difficult to interpret the legislature as intending reasonable cause to mean the same thing as probable cause.
One more issue with respect to the police. In this case, going forward on a PDVA warrant, they get to the defendant. And they're asking, is there anyone else in the apartment? And he refuses to answer. Protective sweep?
They arrest him under a PDV warrant, and he's in the apartment.
He's in the apartment, and they're interested in their safety, and they want to know whether there's anybody else there. He will not answer the question. Can they do a protective sweep?
Again, assuming the validity of the PDV.
Well, that's.
I guess that goes back to the question: was the original warrant validly issued? If it was, then the answer, of course, is yes. Then they can do a protective sweep search. If they had no reason to be in there in the first place, then I would have to answer no.
Is the standard then, coming back to the other question, if the warrant is properly issued under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act without probable cause, reasonable cause, no probable cause, are they lawfully in the premises?
I that addresses the issue under the circumstances in which we try to outline where the along Justice Albin's views that there exist special needs as properly narrowed and defined, then yes, they are validly there.
I'm trying to get to the question that we sort of have in this case, maybe not exactly, but somewhat. They get to the apartment under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. Mm. No finding of probable cause. Purported finding of reasonable cause. They're there. They're in there. Purportedly looking for weapons to protect the victim. They see evidence of criminal activity, drugs, paraphernalia, whatever. Can that be seized and used in a criminal prosecution? Because that's kind of what we have here. That's closer.
Well, I would disagree with that fact, with the latter proposition. They were not, in our view, they were never validly in the apartment.
Because?
They met him. They were outside in the parking lot. There was no reason for them to enter the apartment as an incident to arrest.
Let me go back. Do they have a right to enter, even forcibly, under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act? Well, once he's out of the apartment, okay, different issue. You're saying at that point, go get a search warrant, do whatever you got to do.
They could have secured the apartment, and if they could get a conventional search warrant, then that would be fine. There was no reason in this case.
And if they can't, the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act does not permit them to then enter without a finding of probable cause.
Right. Yes. Okay. I realize I'm imposing on the court's time. I'll just briefly, the second two points. Based a lot on the Ferguson case that we cited in our brief, we believe this case cannot really be said to be, the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act cannot be deemed to be unrelated to law enforcement, which prevents it from coming within the special needs exception. The Prevention of Domestic Violence Act is simply too inextricably intertwined into conventional law enforcement. And actually, I would point to the Attorney General's amicus brief in which they argued that the search warrant was issued predicated upon the finding of probable cause that he committed a crime.
I ask for a succinct statement of your third point now.
Third point was basically stressing the statutory requirement. The legislature required that the judge state with specificity as well as the constitutional requirement. The state in its supplemental brief believes that the judge did that in the order. I urge the court, if it hasn't already done so, to actually look at the order. The language that the state cites as meeting that requirement, we don't agree that it does, is contained in a computer-generated checkoff that is automatically incorporated into the order anytime the judge checks off TRO granted. That, I think, encapsulates the concern that ACLU has in this case, that searches of the potentially almost limitless scope as permitted under Section J are going to become as simple as a checkoff box, and that cannot mean satisfy the specificity requirement.
Suppose in this case there'd been a follow-up question that was posed. How do you know there's a gun at the home? He told me he's got a gun at the apartment. Would that not provide a sufficient basis for a search?
I think on this basis that would be a very different case.
Were you suggesting that checkoff is not enough in the order, that there should be a statement of facts as to why the TRO was issued?
Yes, because I think not only does the fourth
point
require this, the legislature requires
that's on the record, and attorneys obtain the record orders mandate. They don't set forth findings of fact or conclusions of law. They simply say you may or may not do this or you may or may not. Orders mandate parties to do certain things, and the support for that order is found in the record, which can be obtained.
That may be true in the ordinary course here, but here where indeed the legislature went to the point of requiring this, that the judge state with specificity the reasons for and the scope of the search.
Assuming he does that on the record, he or she does that on the record, is the order still infirm because there was a checkoff? I'm just wondering what you think
right,
on the order.
Right, I believe it would be certainly the better practice that it be committed. If you're saying, is it on a transcript that is committed rather than on the order so that it doesn't have too much paper? I think the important thing, one, is that you actually articulate with specificity that it gives something for reviewing courts to actually review. And that might meet the statutory standard, yes.
There's not much more we'd have to put in the basic order, because there is a line that says, the undersigned complaints that said defendant did endanger plaintiff's life, health, well-being, and then it says give specific facts regarding acts or threats of abuse and the dates and times they occurred, specify any weapons. All we'd have to do, and their location of those weapons. So, I mean, the form wouldn't need all that much more.
Possibly not.
Would, in your opinion, would it go beyond this and go to, say, a summary judgment motion? The judge has to put his findings of fact and conclusions all in the order granting summary judgment to follow that on a criminal case?
As for the reasons for granting this search, yes. What I would probably say is, though, because the police officers have to follow it, the articulation of the scope of the search probably should have to be on the warrant, because that's what they're going to be following.
Thank you, Dean Chen. Mr. Liston. See if they work.
Could have tried them on. Good afternoon again, Your Honors. May it please the court, there's no more important state interest than keeping people alive, especially those who are vulnerable. And that's exactly what the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act aims to do. In fact, the act was enacted because the traditional criminal justice system was failing domestic violence victims, in part because it just couldn't respond quickly enough to it to keep a victim safe in an emergent, dangerous, and potentially volatile domestic situation. But also, as illustrated in the report cited by the ACLU in its amicus brief, domestic violence victims are often reluctant to pursue legal remedies because they fear either they won't be taken seriously or they fear their abuser will retaliate against them for reporting the abuse, or they fear the system itself, just that it's too daunting and burdensome to enter into, and they'll only be subjected to further trauma if they do try to take advantage of it. So all this creates a unique challenge for the government, which is responsible for keeping its citizens safe. It's a special government need that the government has beyond normal law enforcement in order to meet that unique challenge. And that's why the legislature spoke so forcefully and enacted the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act and stated its purpose, which was to provide the maximum protection possible to domestic violence victims, the maximum protection that the law can provide. And so as part of the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, judges are authorized to issue a temporary restraining order with a civil search warrant component, only if there is a finding of probable cause to believe that an act of domestic violence has occurred, and then reasonable cause to believe that a weapon will be found in the location to be searched. Now, reasonable cause is a lesser standard than probable cause, but it is justified in this context under the special needs doctrine. And for that reason, TRO search warrants issued under this reasonable cause standard do not violate the state or federal constitution. Now, of course, application of the special needs doctrine requires a balancing of the state's asserted interest against the privacy interest involved. And the state does acknowledge that the privacy interest a person has in his or her home is significant. But again, there's no more important state interest than keeping people alive. And when a domestic violence victim's life may be endangered, the abuser's privacy interests, they must yield. So in this case, there was a domestic violence victim who presented a Superior Court judge with live sworn testimony that the defendant had committed various acts of domestic violence against her, and also that he had various weapons either in his apartment or in one of his cars. And she also presented a certified complaint in which she described an incident where the defendant shocked her with a taser. And that took place in his apartment. And just a brief sidetrack, there was Mr. Bertuccio made the statement in his opening statement that DS was never in the defendant's apartment. Well, again, the certified complaint specifically says that the taser incident happened in the defendant's apartment. So she was there. So there is that. And anyway, so the state submits that these allegations taken all together were sufficient to support a finding of not only reasonable cause to believe that a weapon would be found in the defendant's apartment or in one of his vehicles, but probable cause as well, even if the judge did not explicitly make a finding of probable cause. Nevertheless, the standard, the governing standard is reasonable cause, and based on the victim's testimony, the judge issued a valid search warrant for weapons under that standard. So for that reason, the officers who executed the search warrant for weapons were lawfully inside the defendant's apartment when they observed in plain view the narcotics evidence that formed the basis of the conviction from which the defendant's appealing. And the officer's testimony is very clear on this point, that they entered the defendant's apartment to search for weapons as ordered by the family part judge. They were not there to investigate a narcotics crime or any crime in particular. They were there to search and seize weapons as ordered by the TRO search warrant. And again, these officers were acting in furtherance of a governmental need, a special governmental need, to protect the life and safety of a victim of domestic violence.
How much, based on the facts you present, how burdensome would it have been to establish probable cause? I've been tasered in his apartment before. I've been subjected to domestic violence. I fear for my life. I believe he has weapons, and they're either in his home or in his car or somewhere where he can get to them. And is it that sufficient probable cause? And it does seem very burdensome to go to that standard. I know it's not in the statute, but based on the facts you presented, and how burdensome would it be to add a little bit and go to get probable cause?
Your Honor, I can only say that the state submits the standard was met in this case based on the testimony presented, but the state is really reluctant to impose anything higher than reasonable cause or place the standard at the probable cause level, only because you have a victim coming who's pro se, unrepresented, before a judge, probably in a distraught state, looking for emergent relief.
You agree that probable cause has to be found that there was a domestic violence offense?
Yes.
Okay, so let's start with that. Once you have probable cause to believe there was a domestic violence offense, now we have probable cause to believe that a crime occurred, correct? Because every single category is in either an offense or a crime.
Right.
Correct? So the probable cause to believe that an offense occurred isn't even in the statute. We impose that under DeSpoto, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that you accept?
Yes, the state does.
You accept that the statute didn't have that, but the Constitution required probable cause? You'll concede that?
You have no choice but to agree.
Yeah? So then why wouldn't we, in order to conform the remainder of the statute to constitutional norms, why wouldn't we use probable cause, since we use it for organized crime, gang violence, national security, and many other life-threatening circumstances?
Right. Well, again, the state just submits that these are especially emergent situations.
National security.
Right. But the...
But she's not emergent right now, right? She's standing in front of the judge. You've got so many other options. You have the community caretaking doctrine. When there's an allegation that someone is being subject at that time to domestic violence, and that the police can go in and make sure that everybody is safe. Here she's in court.
This is not going to take an extra step. It's not going to put an additional burden on the state in order to find probable cause.
Okay, a couple things, Your Honor. First, yes, the state is not arguing under the community caretaking doctrine emergency aid for the reason that, yes, the victim
obviously
does
can't.
Go to court.
Obviously, he's in court.
Right.
So there's no community caretaker unless there's a problem in the courtroom itself.
Right.
You just can't raise that, so that's not an issue.
Right, right. And just to make the point that, yes, the state acknowledges there's not like the burning building sort of exigency, that sort of thing. But the exigency, I mean, it's in the statute. There is a certain time sensitivity to it.
You're relying on special needs here.
Right.
And the special needs case law in general involves situations where you can't establish individualized suspicion. You've got a DUI checkpoint. You've got random drug testing and so on. But in these kinds of cases, not only can you, but there is a determination made on the basis of individualized suspicion. Why then is it appropriate to resort to the special needs doctrine?
Right, Your Honor. I will answer that question. I would like to first just quickly finish up answering Justice Tim Cohen's question, which is it's the victims themselves in these situations. It's the burden that meeting the higher standard would place on them, where they may have the information, they may not articulate it well. Again, they're in a distraught state. We're looking to give maximum protection to victims of domestic violence. It just isn't fair to put this burden on them to say, I believe there may be a weapon there, but you really haven't been specific enough, so no, I'm going to deny relief.
So doesn't that argument apply with equal force to a human trafficking allegation?
I mean, it depends on the circumstance, but I mean, there's certainly, vulnerable victim.
And then the logic would be you don't need probable cause to conduct a search of a location for that evidence as well.
I should say that, you know, in making a special needs argument, the state is relying on the legislature's having found a special need as articulated in the legislative findings and declarations.
We understand the language of the statute. The question, of course, is does it comport with the constitutional requirement? And I'll ask you to try to respond to the earlier question. Why does special needs fit when we're dealing with cases that rise or fall on the basis of individualized suspicion with a live victim in front of the court?
Right. Well, I mean, the special need is just the fact that we're talking about something beyond law enforcement. Where, as far as the seizure of a weapon, as some of the questioning got at earlier, the weapon itself, the presence of it in a residence may be perfectly legal, but because of the domestic violence situation, to protect the victim, it should be removed until there's a cooling off, where it's no longer a threat to the victim's safety.
So you say beyond law enforcement, the victim is appearing before a judge. Now, the judge, if properly instructed, can make an appropriate inquiry to protect the victim by asking the right questions. That's the probable cause is now defining a criminal act that occurred, and law enforcement are now carrying out the search and the arrest of the defendant, yes? So I'm trying to figure out how is this unrelated to law enforcement?
Well, not entirely unrelated, but the reason why it must be law enforcement officers who actually execute the search because of the dangerousness of the situation. We can't have social workers going
in. No one's suggesting. Of course they should be involved. That's what the statute indicates.
Right.
The only question is whether or not somehow we should throw out the Constitution is just inadequate to deal with these situations. It can deal with almost any other situation, but somehow the Constitution has to be suspended in domestic violence cases.
Sorry, you're asking?
Take that as a question.
That's the thing.
I'm loaded.
No, well, I mean, the special needs doctrine just acknowledges that when there is a special interest, special government need, that can't be met by normal law enforcement, that we have to balance that interest against the privacy interests. And again, the legislative findings make it clear that the traditional justice system was not working. That is why the act was passed, because there needed to be just another system that could act faster and meet the needs of victims better. Again, based on all the concerns that I said.
What's wrong with the three prongs in Harris? That conforms to the Constitution. Do you not think that that will adequately protect domestic violence victims and also conform the statutory requirements to the Constitution?
No, Your Honor. Again, it's a concern for the victim.
Tell me how it fails. Why any one of those prongs somehow will leave domestic violence victims somehow without appropriate security?
Right. Well, it really is just the prong, the changing reasonable cause to,
Harris,
know, as to be a higher standard.
The Harris standard, as written, tell me if I'm wrong, requires all three of those prongs to be met in order for there to be probable cause. Do you read it the same way? It uses the word and instead of or.
This in the majority opinion?
No, I'm sorry, the dissenting opinion in Harris.
Right.
It's probable cause to believe that an act of domestic violence has been committed by the defendant. Probable cause to believe a search for and seizure of weapons is necessary to protect the life, health, or well-being of the victim on whose behalf the relief is sought. And probable cause to believe that the weapons are located in the place to be searched.
Yes.
That's all three must be as that is stated. So if, for example, a victim came before the court and was not able to identify the location of weapons, or in fact didn't even know where the person lived, that would fail under that standard, correct? There would be no finding of probable cause, because the third prong would be unmet.
Right, if the judge who was hearing the complaint
if you could draw reasonable inferences. A person with a gun attacks a domestic violence victim in the street with a gun. The defendant is arrested. There's no gun. A natural inference would be it's in his home. You'd have probable cause every day of the week, correct?
If the victim could articulate those facts to the satisfaction of the judge.
That's not much to articulate. Someone attacked me with a gun, and he lives there, and the defendant doesn't have a gun. You're off to the races with a search warrant under normal criminal standards, correct?
Right, but again, it depends on the victim's ability, again, unrepresented, to satisfy the judge.
It's not just the victim's ability. That kind of circumstance in a domestic violence case is very rare. Most of them are a threat, a confrontation. They don't specifically at the time involve a weapon. It would be vastly different if defendant on the street threatens the victim. They dated, they've gone out a few times, and then you end up with a scenario Justice Patterson spoke about. He retreats to his home, he threatened to shoot her, whatever. From that circumstance, you'd have a much more difficult time, correct? I mean, isn't that the vast majority of the kind of DV cases we're talking about? Those kind? Versus the actual weapon showing up? Usually when the weapon shows up, it's too late.
Right.
Okay, just throwing it out there.
Let me ask you something else. Have you ever tried any of these cases?
Not personally, no.
Okay.
Most
of the time, the victims are scared, they're vulnerable, they were in special situations. This is not somebody who was robbed or homeland security issue. Many times, they withdraw. Soon when they see the accused, they seek to dismiss their complaints, and they have difficulty because they're not self-represented, and they don't have. They're afraid of the accused, and they may not be able because of that to articulate as well as someone who was robbed, but it's not someone that's subject to abuse every day. Is that factor in?
Right, I think what Your Honor is getting at, and let me first say I actually have to correct my answer. I've never tried a case. However, I did have a case involving a domestic violence victim who made a complaint, and when time moved on, she wanted to withdraw that.
It's so common that before they're allowed to withdraw, they go to the domestic violence unit, and they're explaining to them about the circle of violence and those type of things to explain it to them?
Right, yes. But nevertheless, it may be that the victim either has been intimidated, doesn't want her children taken away. Again, it's being intimidated.
I'm just pointing out that this is not the typical where someone's robbed in a liquor store and they identify the victim and say he had a gun. There's a lot more vulnerability and fear here, isn't there?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Can you address an issue that we discussed with Dean Shen? Was there any basis to enter the apartment aside from the DV Act warrant?
There was discussion about the protective sweep, and there was, of course, a protective sweep that did, in fact, take place. But nevertheless, It did depend on the police officers being authorized to enter the apartment by virtue of the domestic violence search warrant.
And thus we would need to address the constitutional question.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor may be referencing the appellate division's opinion where it seems to be a little bit of a leap.
Correct.
where there's, seems like there's the contempt, there's the interaction that happens outside the apartment, and then we go right to a protective sweep inside the apartment. No, the protective sweep that did in fact occur, if you look at the officer's testimony, they did say because they had heard the defendant say he didn't know whether anyone else was in the apartment, they, you know, had a warrant saying that there were weapons inside. Before they actually searched for any weapons, they wanted to just go quickly through and check any place where a person could be hiding.
The officers acted in good faith. They had a court order.
Absolutely.
The question is whether the constitutional standard is adequate under the order that they had.
Right. Right, Your Honor. Yes.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
I believe I hit everything.
And if not, Mr. Murawski is ready to go.
Right. Sorry. There was just one other quick thing to mention. When Mr. Bertuccio was making his opening statement, indicated that the victim's testimony at the TRO hearing didn't make any mention of the defendant's residence. But if you look at page 5, line 6 of the TRO transcript, the question is, where does he have these, meaning the weapons? Special compartments in his car,
yeah,
and at his apartment.
Yeah.
So it is in the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, the Attorney General would like one thing, our position clear at the outset. That the domestic violence search warrant under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act is a protective search. It is a warrant, a judicial order to conduct a protective search. It is not a judicial order to conduct a further criminal investigation. And to get to the point about the Johnson three prongs, that's an awful lot of probable cause to find in order to protect a person. The police never have to find that much probable cause in order to protect themselves. The police don't have to find that much probable cause to enter a house under the community caretaking doctrine or under the emergency aid doctrine. We're talking about a protective search.
Do you not accept the Johnson factors? Are you
the
saying
three probable cause findings?
So State versus Johnson set forth three factors for the issuance of a warrant for the search for weapons, correct?
Right.
Is the state's position is that we should reject State versus Johnson?
Well, as far as the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act is concerned, probable cause should not be needed for a judge to find that there are weapons present that could endanger the victim. To the extent Johnson incorporates that probable cause standard.
No, it has reasonable cause. So what we did with Johnson in DeSpoto on the first prong said probable cause. So I'm assuming since Johnson came out, I don't think, 2002, and unless it's been reversed, which it hasn't been, that the state is observing it, that is currently the law, no?
Well, I think Your Honor touched upon the standard that was changed from good cause to probable cause. I think what everyone was struggling with in DeSpoto was what exactly does good cause mean? And I think the court came to a reasonable conclusion that good cause, for all practical purposes, has to be probable cause because we wouldn't know what else it is. But reasonable grounds is very clearly defined, or clear enough, I should say. None of these standards are overly clear, but it's clear enough that it's less than probable cause. And less than probable cause should be enough when we're talking about the protection of people. And it must be pointed out that the legislature, no less than three times in the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, used the word emergency. The judge has to find that this is an emergency. This is not a time for the calm deliberation of a criminal investigation. The legislature finds this to be an emergency. Because of as Mr. Liston pointed out, the existing criminal tools that existed at the time weren't working. The legislature found that those existing rules were not working.
Wouldn't you agree that the finding of an emergency is fact-specific? There could be cases where it is an extraordinary emergency and others where there's not.
Well,
the legislature put the label on a category of offenses and satisfy the constitutional requirement?
Well, it created a special need that domestic violence, because of its intimate nature and volatile nature, and because victims are so reluctant to fully cooperate with the police, that this creates a sufficient enough emergency where the probable cause standard would be too high of a burden for the police to meet in order to serve their protective functions of the victim.
So could that very principle apply in other areas of law as well?
If the legislature...
human trafficking, victims of gang violence, and so on.
Or dangerous gun owners, as we've seen last year. But yes, if the legislature made a finding that the probable cause standard is not adequately protecting victims in serving the state's protective function, not the investigative function, then the legislature can, I mean, of course, it has to be a legitimate special need.
There's not going to be very much left of the Fourth Amendment under that standard. I mean, the whole purpose of the framers enacting the Fourth Amendment is that the state legislature wouldn't create standards lower than that. And the Fourth Amendment talks about unreasonable searches and seizures.
Well,
of many things, people, homes, things, and effects. But we've repeatedly said that the sanctity of the home is the chief evil against which the Fourth Amendment was written, correct?
We do. And the United States Supreme Court said in Camara that because it's time for a fire inspection, the state can enter your home. I mean, that's less of a suspicion than we have in this case.
You know, it's interesting. I know you cited Camara. The end result of Camara was that the Supreme Court said you needed a warrant in those
circumstances. You needed a warrant, but you didn't need a warrant with the classical criminal probable cause that required a fair probability that particular evidence would be found in a particular place. It required a pragmatic probable cause standard, which you have here when you combine the finding of probable cause that domestic violence has occurred. This court said in DeSpoto, that process is inseparable. It's not to be bifurcated. In order to get a TRO, the search warrant's part of the TRO. In order to get a TRO, you need probable cause. That probable cause, in addition to the reasonable cause, satisfies the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, and state constitution's reasonableness requirement. The reasonableness requirement is the touchstone of both the Fourth Amendment and the state constitution. This legislature's careful scheme meets that reasonableness.
Not for the entry of a home. And what I'm wondering is even under this case, even Harris, we said that the probable cause standard would have been met. With a couple of extra inquiries by the court, you don't think that the state would have been able to meet the probable cause standard in this case?
Oh, we have no doubt, Your Honor, that the state would have. They did. And in a majority of cases, an overwhelming majority of cases, the state probably would meet the probable cause standard because, after all, the victim would probably be providing a first-hand basis of knowledge and they're a reliable witness. But what about those few cases where the victim is unable to show probable cause, but yet they show reasonable cause, and now they're not getting the full protection that the legislature has allowed them.
So
even one loss would be a tragedy.
What would that be? Would that be a situation where, to me, tell me if I'm wrong, where there may be a window there of cases is where the location of weapons is uncertain based upon the witness of the victim's testimony?
That certainly could be a category of circumstances where you have reasonable grounds but not quite probable cause to meet the specificity requirement that the Constitution requires for criminal search warrants.
Right, because the alleged abuser has not confided in the victim anything about his or her home or where weapons might be kept,
or
hasn't even necessarily identified a particular weapon that
exactly
exists.
Exactly. And suppose the perpetrator says, I'm going to blow your head off. Well, what's the victim supposed to think? He's going to blow my head off with what? He's going to blow my head off with a gun, and he must have a gun if he's talking about it. So
that
might be a case.
Wouldn't that satisfy probable cause?
Well, it would be probable cause under the special needs doctrine to get a domestic violence warrant, but would it meet the classic criminal standard of, does he have a gun in his house? I'll blow your head off. I mean, that might be controversial.
In that case, where they do not quite meet the probable cause standard to search for the weapons, but they've met reasonable cause, they have probable cause to believe an act of domestic violence occurred, would whatever they seize in that apartment or home then be admissible in a criminal prosecution?
Absolutely, because they're lawfully in the house. And nowhere in this court or United States Supreme Court has it ever been found that the police are lawfully in the viewing area or in the judiciary.
Well, forget viewing area. Assume they had to go search the house.
Well, they're lawfully
in the house. They find it in a drawer in the fifth Bureau of the
right, wherever they found it, if they're lawfully doing what they're doing, pursuant to a lawful judicial order under the legislation, to say, well, you can do that, but then you can't use the evidence. The founding fathers didn't contemplate such a bifurcated solution to a constitutional violation. The Fourth Amendment means you can't go in. Period.
That's happened.
But you're suggesting that the legislature declares something, an emergency such as this, and that can do away with the Fourth Amendment.
No, they can't
do it. What happens when it happens again and again? What remains of the Fourth Amendment at that point?
They can't do it with the Fourth Amendment. This legislation is entirely within the Fourth Amendment's special needs doctrine. There has to be a careful scheme laid out by the legislature, which is done here. This isn't just, well, you have probable cause, go search this whole house for every sharp object. It requires that there has to be a continuing danger. The judge has to find that there's a continuing danger. Now, that could be implicit when someone threatens to throw acid in your face. It says that the judge has to find other emergency relief, and that other emergency relief may include ordering the search for and seizure of any weapons that may be used against the victim. And then, finally, near the end of the statute, it requires the judge shall state with specificity the reasons for any scope of any search and seizure authorized by the order. That meets the reasonableness standard, which is really at the bottom of the Fourth Amendment.
So I know that I agree with you that once you're if you're lawfully in the house, that's it. Whatever you see, you see. Okay. But the legislature could write schemes concerning organized crime, gang violence, human traffic, any number of things, and come up with reasonable cause for, and maybe there will be this small number of cases where reasonable cause doesn't meet the probable cause. What happens to the Constitution? Do we now bring down the constitutional safeguard that is supposed to be guiding the legislation so that the legislation is now guiding the Constitution?
No, Your Honor, you don't have to lower any standards in the Constitution because the Constitution requires reasonableness. And if the police are solving a particular problem where the legislature has identified it cannot be solved under traditional law enforcement tools, then they could take an alternative protective measure.
Other than exigent circumstances, and we've said that repeatedly, you can get into a house on exigent circumstances. So far, at least, our constitutional jurisprudence requires probable cause to get into a home. Am I wrong about that?
Well, exigent circumstances, if you define that as the emergency aid doctrine, community caretaking
so
doctrine.
So outside of that, we have that. And you don't need a warrant for that. Yeah. You just go right into the house. Outside of that, where is there a standard of less than probable cause to get into a house?
When there's an emergency situation, as the legislature has found here, this is considered a species of an emergency. The legislature is instructing law enforcement.
An emergency.
Or this as an emergency.
What is needed for the legislature to find an emergency, aside from a majority vote?
Well, the judge has to make findings that the victim is in danger of.
No. For the legislature, you're talking about there's a legislative scheme here. Is there something needed beyond a good faith determination by a legislative body?
Well, I'm sure the legislature had, and this court has found, and the Attorney General agrees that there was a need for this. No one disagrees that there was a need for the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act.
Isn't it a situation where, if we're talking about an organized crime investigation, the police are involved, presumably. There is an investigation going on, evidence is being accumulated. We have here a situation where a victim may come in, may have no contact with police officers, appears before a judge, things have just happened within the last hour. Obviously an unsophisticated person who has never been part of the system and as Justice Fernandez-Vini was pointing out, often really scared. Can there be a probable cause definition for a refinement of the probable cause standard in terms of the location of weapons that could be a meaningful probable cause standard and conform with the constitutional requirements above reasonable cause, but which takes into account the fact that an unrepresented victim, potentially under stress, may not be able to articulate locations in the same way a police officer would in an affidavit. See what I'm saying?
Right, but the anything more than the reasonable grounds would be more than is the legislature has defined what is reasonable, because when you talk about standards, I mean, there's not many. I mean, you got probable cause, you got reasonable grounds.
I understand. What I'm suggesting is that I think the focus of the concern here, because one prong is already at a probable cause record level, right?
Yes.
Is that group of cases as to which there's uncertainty as to the location because of the circumstances. So is there a way, and you're arguing in your brief that probable cause was met here in this particular case, but this case aside, is there a way to adjust that third prong about location in a way that takes into account the nature of these applications, which are not made by police officers generally, but are made by victims who don't even understand what the standard that they're trying to meet. See what I'm saying?
I do see that whether there could be a standard, but there's really no better substitution than the reasonableness standard. Reasonableness takes everything into consideration.
So think of Justice Patterson's question in terms of the particularity requirement. Would it aid the jurisprudence if the court were to recognize that it is unreasonable to expect that a victim who has been threatened would be able to specify with particularity the location of a weapon in an apartment?
That could be dangerous. A victim that's unable to do that can find themselves in a fatal situation.
I don't think you heard the full question. Would it help for the court to acknowledge that in an opinion, that it is unreasonable to expect the level of particularity for
yes.
the location of the weapon?
Yes, understanding your question now, yes, that would be actually, it should be essential that this court recognize that
right.
difficulty.
Right, probable cause isn't a high standard in itself.
No.
It's just a well-grounded suspicion.
Fair
even the example that you were given, I'm going to blow your head off, which suggests that the person has a gun, may lead to certain inferences that could lead to a well.
Right, but I'm sure plenty of lawyers would argue, and many trial judges might find, well, you don't have specificity that he has a gun anywhere. You don't know exactly where it is. You don't know what kind of gun. We could see the litigation that would ensue from that. Litigation that should be unnecessary when a victim's life is at stake.
So we know that probable cause is a well-grounded suspicion. Now, tell me what your reasonable cause is. Give me your definition of reasonable cause set off against a well-grounded suspicion.
It's like a reasonable articulable suspicion similar to that from a Terry standard.
Yeah.
If the judge
reasonable
can find
and look
reasonable.
Look what the hair splitting we're doing here. Okay? I know there's a difference between a reasonable and articulable suspicion. Okay? That's your reasonable cause, probable cause, a well-grounded suspicion. And you're saying between those two, one that conforms with the Constitution and one that doesn't, that somehow what the foundations of what the Republic are about to collapse.
The reasonable articulable suspicion satisfies the protective search need. The courts have found that in Terry. The courts have found that in the exigent circumstances, the emergency aid doctrine. Reasonable suspicion is a constitutional standard. It depends on the circumstances. Probable cause isn't the end-all and be-all of the Fourth Amendment. It's not, and it never was, ever since 1791. It was reasonableness is really the touchstone. Reasonableness trumps even probable cause. At the end of the day, when the police are conducting a search that serves a vital need as found by the legislature and agreed on by all three branches of government, that probable cause is insufficient to protect people,
since
not to
1791,
prosecute.
Unless you can cite me a case, absent exigent circumstances, you don't get into a house with a search warrant without probable cause. That's in 1791.
Well, you have
maybe we'll make an exception in 2019. But
so you do have a probable cause finding here. You have the probable cause finding that the defendant committed an act of domestic violence. That's the probable cause component that under the special needs doctrine can satisfy the special needs probable cause standard. The special needs probable cause standard is not a rigid replication of the criminal probable cause standard, because the priority here is protecting the victims. Anything found as a result is secondary. In fact, many times the guns are lawfully owned and they're even given back to the suspect. So
I don't disagree. So on the second prong in Harris doesn't even disagree with what you're saying there. Probable cause believe the search for weapons is necessary to protect the life, health, or well-being.
It should be It should be reasonable grounds to believe that.
Well, I understand your difference.
And that difference, and we acknowledge that that difference is not going to result in a vast number of cases. But you know, every
really that difference on number on the prong two. You tell me if I'm wrong. The prong two, it's pretty hard to imagine a big window between reasonable cause to believe a search for and seizure of weapons is necessary to protect the life and probable cause to believe. I mean, my concern is more the potential for real life cases that may fit into a window in the third prong.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's what the legislature was concerned about, that's what the Attorney General is concerned about, and that's what this court has said about the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act in the past. It's to give maximum protection of the victims of domestic violence. And that little you could call it notch in between reasonable suspicion and probable cause could be the difference of life and death. And we ask for that standard to be imposed. We think that the legislature's scheme is reasonable, it's measured, it's fully constitutional within the special needs doctrine. We're not suggesting it meets the criminal standard. We never did, nor need it. This is a protective search at its bottom, and we ask that for this protective search to be given full effect, that reasonable grounds be used after probable cause is found that an act of domestic violence has occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Murawski. Mr. Petuccia, did you want to offer rebuttal?
Very, very, very briefly.
Kind of just want to bring this back to James Hemingway's case. There was not probable cause in this transcript, nor sufficient specificity or particularized locations to satisfy the probable cause standard to issue this warrant. Therefore, the warrant was invalid, and therefore the police had no other justification to cross the threshold into the apartment complex and up into the apartment, which was, according to this alleged victim, where my client lived and deserves the highest sanctity. There's no exigent circumstances here. You can't invoke community caretaking or protective suite because they had no right to be there in the first place. And lastly, I would say, Chief Justice, as you well know, even though they acted in good faith, you could make that argument, there's no good faith exception to the warrant requirement at the state court level. State versus Novembrino speaks to that. The last point I'd make is I heard from the state how there's this unusual need in domestic violence cases to protect the alleged victims. And we had cited a case, Skinner, in which Thurgood Marshall, I believe, dissented and said, drugs is a scourge in this nation. I think we'll talk about the opioid epidemic. And he said there is no doubt that if we suspended the Fourth Amendment for one day and just went house to house, we would get tons of drugs and guns and other things off the streets, and we would save lives. But yet there's still a higher purpose, and the constitutional standard addresses an equal, if not more important, interest in the privacy of your home. And that was violated here, I respectfully submit, because it was the wrong standard. The transcript was woefully short of probable cause. My point in my opening arguments is this victim never said she lived there or was in that house. She doesn't specify in her complaints where exactly the taser situation happened, but she doesn't testify to any of that in this transcript. And the judge had the complaint. It would have been easy, as Justice Alvin said repeatedly this afternoon, to just ask a few more questions.
Can I ask a question? Assume sure. You prevail on the question of the constitutional standard.
Right.
A record exists, and a trial judge made determinations based on the standard that was in effect at the time of reasonable cause. Would it make sense to remand to allow the judge to consider the existing record, not take more testimony, and determine whether it would satisfy a probable cause requirement?
No, there's been, I think we said it in a brief, there's been cases that say that this is not a situation where you do that. If the facts do not meet the probable cause standard, court determines it.
That's the question that I'm suggesting, that is there a basis for a remand to allow that very question to be resolved?
No, because I believe the case law says if you fail to meet the standard, the warrant's illegal, and the result is that the evidence is suppressed. It's that simple.
No, the question that the chief is asking suggesting is that if we set forth a standard that is different than the one under which the trial court was operating, should we send it back so that trial judge or another trial judge can look at the existing record to see whether it meets the standard that this court sets.
And I understand the question, and my answer is no. It's no different than if you're here looking at a search warrant affidavit, and the question is, did it satisfy probable cause or not?
But is it different in this sense? With a probable cause affidavit, you know from minute one the standard is probable cause. Here, the trial judge understandably made a determination whether there was reasonable cause. If we decide you're correct and that the threshold has to be probable cause, what's wrong with sending it back to the trial judge and say, is there enough here in the existing record?
Because if this panel looks at this and says, well, we believe this does not satisfy probable cause, then there's no point in a remand. It's
That's
not
fair.
A
so
remand.
You want us to decide it instead
yes,
of sending
absolutely.
It back?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. Next, we have the two...